Hello and welcome back to Kvikmyndapod, an Icelandic cinema podcast. I'm Rob Watts, and as ever, I'm joined by my good friend Ellie Cawthorn for another journey through the world of Icelandic cinema. Our film this week is Driving Mum, or Aferð með Mömmu, and it shares some DNA with last week's movie, A Letter from Helga. The two star the same actors, share similar themes, and are set, at least to begin with, in the Westfjords, that ancient, remote and rugged peninsula in the northwest of Iceland. Out in UK cinemas on the 1st of March, today if you're listening as the podcast drops, Hilmar Oddsson's Driving Mum centres on Jón and his mum taking a road trip from their Westfjordian farm to a small town on the south of the island. There's a bit more to the story than that, which Ellie and I discuss in detail. One thing we didn't discuss was the recent announcement of the 2024 EDDA Award nominations. But we must, for Driving Mum has been nominated for Film of the Year, Screenplay of the Year, and Director of the Year, alongside our first episode film, Wild Game. Congratulations to both films. They're up against a film called Solitude, Tilverur, which we haven't yet seen, so cannot comment on. Congratulations also to everyone else who has been nominated, including Thruster Leo, Vivian Olafsdottir, most of the cast of Wild Game, lots of people involved in Cold or Kuldi, hopefully that'll get a UK release soon, and Tonu Korvitz for their score for Driving Mum. Here's to an exciting awards ceremony on the 13th of April. One final thing before our chat, a quick reminder that you can follow us on X, Instagram and Threads at Kvikmyndapod, that's KvikMyndApod, and you can support us by chucking us little coffee money at ko-fi.com/Kvikmyndapod. We are also now on Discord, just search for Kvikmyndapod and join in all kinds of discussions with fellow listeners from around the world. Cheers!
Þetta móður þín?
Já.
Sæl, frú mín. Hún dauð.
Þú ert að grenja.
Grenja? Nei, ég var ekki að grenja.
Hægri, vinstri. Is she okay?
Hún dauð.
Okay.
No problem.
Í kjallaranum, dúa, í kjallaranum.
Má ég fá mér sæti? Sæti. Þetta sérstaklega fyrir þig.
Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Rob.
We're in another room today.
Ooh, treat ourselves to a different room.
I've put some sound dampeners on the wall.
Hopefully, then, for everybody, we sound very unechoey.
Yeah, but who knows? This is an experiment. If it works, we've got a little podcast room rather than my echoey kitchen.
Perfect.
Yeah. So, for this week's film, we're going to do one that is literally out as we speak on the day of this podcast dropping. It's being released in the UK, 1st of March. This is Driving Mum, or in Icelandic, as I always say, is Aferð með Mömmu.
Mm-hmm.
So Driving Mum. It sounds like it is, basically.
I mean, yeah, you've got basically a two-word synopsis of the film there, haven't you? A man drives his mum across Iceland. But there is a little bit more to it than that.
There is. I mean, I'll read out this little synopsis that I wrote, half of which you just said. But once we've read that out, we'll go from there. When Jón's mum passes away one night, he honours her wishes and takes her on a cross-country ride from the Westfjords to the south to lay her to rest. Dressed in her finest and with a face full of makeup, she sits in the back of the old Ford Cortina like a passenger and often chimes in with unhelpful and rude comments about Jón and his life. As their journey progresses, Jón comes to terms with his situation and how things might have turned out differently if it wasn't for his mum. Mm. Also, their dog Brezhnev is with them.
Oh my god, the cutest dog of all time!
And this one gets so much more screen time as well than in Wild Games. Great. So yeah, based on that synopsis, it starts off like, okay, it's kind of road movie type thing. A bit weird that he's like dressed his mum up and sat her in the back. But then she starts talking to him.
Yeah.
What?
Well, I feel like this movie, more than anything else, makes me think of those kind of eccentric, kooky films from the 2000s.
Okay, like what?
A bit like Noe Albineoe,
Oh, where, yeah.
Who actually makes an appearance in sure this film? Sure does. Noe himself. Where we basically have this kind of weird and whimsical road trip and meet these different strange characters along mm-hmm. the way who kind of come in and out in the different chapters. And again, it's a black comedy of the blackest type, I guess, with the dead mum in the back. Mm-hmm. But it is played with a kind of sardonic humour, isn't it?
Yeah, it is funny. Mm-hmm. It is dark, classic Icelandic film. But it has this emotional core as well. Mm-hmm. Like, the tone kind of shifts all the time. And that's kind of amplified by the music as well, which we'll talk about. But it's like, at times it's really jovial. Mm. And then at times you've got, like, Johan having this crisis. It's a kind of magical realist road trip in yes. a way. Stuff happens. It seems so normal.
I think magical realist is a good way of describing it, because you kind of have to enter the universe of this film and go with the rules of this universe, because if you'd applied any kind of like logic to uh-huh. it would all fall apart, because, you know, he would never behave this way, so and so wouldn't have done this. You just have to kind of go with it and yeah. accept this is not you know, a naturalistic portrayal.
No, and that's funny, even as they're driving through the real world, and they call it the outside world in chapter two. But like, Iceland looks like Iceland. It looks stunning. But yeah, the story that's going throughout that landscape is one that's a little bit weirder.
For sure.
Like we said, it's handy. This film starts with chapters. It has chapters mm. throughout. So why don't we take it chapter by chapter and we'll pick up on everything as we go. So chapter one, beginning and end. So it's the beginning of the film. Mm. This is me reading into what the chapter titles mean.
I don't think you need to be, you know, that smart a film critic to,
I don't
to
know.
Understand
this. I was
going to
give myself some sort of award, actually. Yeah. The beginning of the film and the end of his mother's life.
Yeah.
So the film starts, and again, we're in the Westfjords. It's 1980 this time. So we've jumped on 40 years since A Letter from Helga last week, but we're in a similar area of the country.
And to be honest, in the first kind of opening shot of this, it's all shot in black and white, worth mm-hmm. saying, and maybe I'm going to ask you about that in a minute, but we have this shot of Johan and his mum knitting, sat side by side in their armchairs knitting with the radio on. And yeah, it's 1980, but it could be, you know, 1940, 1960,
oh, so
1910.
Yeah. The only thing that really tells you it's 1980, other than the on-screen writing that's like 1980, is the fact that actually they can't receive the radio, so they get it delivered by cassette tape. So that's the only moment in that like opening that could possibly take you to the 80s rather than any other time prior to that.
I loved though that scene as a opening gambit to kind of lay out the dynamic between him and his mum. So they're both sat next to each other with nowhere to kind of go, nothing to do. She suggests maybe we could go to X, Y, and Z, and he's like, "Oh, I don't think so." I mean, even the ball, their balls of wool that they're knitting are like intertwined, tangled
Ooh,
together.
Metaphor.
Hashtag metaphor.
Hey, that's not what I read into it, but I love it.
Yeah. They're enmeshed and they're in this small world mm-hmm. where it's just the two of them. You get the sense that they've been sat together knitting these jumpers every day for the last 30 years.
Yeah. That moment, though, when they're knitting, because you can't, I didn't go into this film not knowing. I knew that the mum was dead. I think it's pretty clear from the trailer. I was like just anticipating a death from the start. And they're knitting and the wool is getting tangled and tangled and tighter. And I was like, oh my God, is she going to get like a needle to the head or something? That's my horror mind at work, I suppose. But like, it was felt quite tense, I thought, because they're having a mini argument about, you know, Gullfoss and it's all been too long. And then just slowly these balls of yarn are like getting closer and closer and the it's getting tighter and tighter. And I was like, oh my God, is the needle just going to fly out of her hand or something?
It's not that often that you see knitting as a, you know, a form of tension on screen.
No. Sightseers. Have you seen Sightseers?
Years ago.
Well, someone dies from a knitting needle in that film. Okay. So maybe the only death by knitting needle. I'm not sure.
What is it in? Oh, it was in a book I just read where somebody got shot with a knitting needle in like a bow and arrow, but the arrow was a knitting needle.
What book was that?
It was called Wild.
But it's not the real life story of
it's set in the Wild West.
Okay. Knitting needles in the Wild West, yeah?
Well, yeah, you've got to make do with what's available to you on the frontier.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Okay. That sounds interesting.
I
love these
there.
Divergence, yeah.
To take us back from that divergence, one thing I wanted to ask you for your take on was, why is this film in black and white?
Why? From a purely filmmaking standpoint, like money
looks
type
beautiful.
Thing, it does look beautiful. I think it was probably to help with the...
aesthetic.
The aesthetic, and we're in 1980, and it probably just irons out things from looking too new. To
it
a degree.
Looks very crisp and gorgeous, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's that thing of like the Iceland landscape, as we always say, is stunning, it's dangerous, it's all of these things. But that kind of layer of black and white kind of adds a bit more of a murkiness
An
to
artifice,
it.
Artifice, though, as well. So, yeah. You know, the idea that you said earlier about it being kind of magical realism, maybe it helps with that sense. And when we get some figures coming in that would probably discuss that are kind of like circusy mime figures, it does have that
more of a dream quality,
a dreamlike quality.
Yeah,
yes,
because
exactly.
I could see a film like this being done in like really, really crazy, vivid, psychedelic kind of colors to make it feel like that. But I think black and white was a really good choice. It just looks brilliant, doesn't it? And it's not often you see black and white, certainly not in Icelandic film that we've. Is this the first one we've come across? I think it
probably,
is.
Yeah.
And it looks amazing. Yeah. So that's it, really. That's my thoughts on why it's black and white. But I like your idea, because when these characters come in and out, it just helps kind of blur that line between what's real and what's not. Yeah, so they're knitting, and basically she says, I've never been to Gullfoss. I have been to Geysir, though. I'm like, well, for me, they're so close to each other. I'm quite surprised that she didn't go to both on that trip with her mum. But anyway, she never went. Something she wants to do. And then she dies in her bed at night. She knows she's going to die as well, which is kind of a stranger thing.
No, I think she's just of a certain age. I think maybe the actress is... got quite a kind of vigorous sense of life to her. She doesn't seem very frail, does she? So it doesn't feel like she's about to fall over dead. But I guess the idea is that she's just meant to be dying of old age, right?
I guess. I mean, she doesn't... Yeah, she looks old, but not old.
She looks healthy, though.
Yeah, and like her character, she's obviously quite a domineering lady. Mm. And we learn a lot about her past. But she comes across quite strong-minded, strong-willed. Not weak, but yeah, she must have this sense that things are coming to an end. I don't feel like she was pulling out her finery every day before she went to bed, you know. So yeah, she passes away. And what does Jon have to do? He's got to take her, honour her final wishes, which she happens to have told him earlier that day, which is to lay her to rest down in the south.
But first, he has to put a bit of a slap on her.
Yeah, he does. I mean, tell me about someone who, you know, wears makeup.
I thought that was a great touch, actually. The makeup kind of sets the tone that things are going to be really absurd.
Yes.
And so when she, he obviously has never been put makeup on anyone. So she looks absolutely like a kind of deranged clown. And I think that that's very a very good move, because it's saying like, okay, this is a kind of film we're into. We're not doing like a very serious take on this.
No, you can laugh at the dead.
Some bizarre elements at play.
Yes, for sure.
And gives her this like otherworldly look for the rest of the film.
Yeah, it's by turns funny and creepy.
Mm.
And that, yeah, just with that presence in the back of the car for like the whole film, it's, you can't ignore it. You can't forget what film we're in. Mm. But she wants to be arrested where her family are down south, not at the farm. And, you know, in that opening shot, we can see crosses in front of the farm, which is obviously where most of the family have been laid to rest. So she doesn't want that. She wants to go down south and specifically not to be cremated.
Mm.
Which is an interesting thought.
Keep that thought in your mind.
Hvað ætlaðu að gera þegar ég dey?
Ha?
Þú heyrðir hvað ég sagði.
Þú ert ekkert að deyja, það?
Já, það veit ég ekkert.
Nei, ég ætla að segja það.
Ég vil ekki að þú verðir einn hér.
Ég hef nú hundinn.
Ég hef áhyggjur að þér.
Ég bjarga mér.
Þú manst hverju þú lofaðir?
Já, já.
Lofvörð er lofvörð.
Ég veit það.
Hvað gerurðu við mig þegar ég dey?
Það ekki margt sem hægt að gera þegar þú ert dauð.
Hvað gerurðu við mig?
Ég kem þér fyrir.
Hvar?
Hjá kallinum.
Nei.
Nei, fyrir sunnan í þorpinu.
Á Eyrabakka?
Já, á Eyrabakka.
From there on, Jón is in the car in his trusty old Ford Cortina with his dog, Brezhnev. Mm. Why he's named after that Russian political dude, I don't really know.
I guess it's just a nod to the 80s.
Reminder of where we are.
There, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And they go on a road trip. And it's quite funny because he's clearly, at least not since he was a youth, left the town. And the second chapter is called The Outside World, as I say. So he's venturing out, but he's so remote. Like we saw in A Letter from Helga, like it's not that easy to get to and from where they are. And he's driving along pebble beaches, along mountainous crevasses and all of this stuff in the oldest car you've ever seen with a dead lady and his dog.
Mm.
And it's just fantastic. Like the imagery alone,
yeah,
is enough to kind of get you going.
And basically from there, it is fairly linear, isn't it? We basically have these kind of chapters or these little encounters with different strange characters on the road and then move on from them.
Yeah.
Did you like that structure?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic. Someone goes on a journey, they meet people, they end up in a different place to the start, geographically and mentally or psychologically or what have you. And the first people they meet, the Germans.
Yes.
Which, wow, it's the 1980s, but the mum, she's not holding back, is she?
No. So this is when she first kind of appears to Jón to be speaking.
Mm.
Because as up until this point, she has just been kind of a dead body. And then she comes, you know, reanimated, clearly in his imagination.
Like, well, that's a key point, isn't it?
Yeah.
You say clearly in his imagination. I think, yeah, we have to accept that it's not happening.
Yes.
But it's, so are we supposed to think everything that she says then is a projection of his
absolutely thoughts? It's basically him thinking, you know, what would mum say? What would mum think? What would mum do? Because he's spent his whole life being so influenced by her.
Yeah, with her in his ear.
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm. But the first thing she says is how he needs to stand up for himself and that the Germans are bad,
yes,
referring to them as Nazis.
Yes. So we get a sense that, you know, she's not a very kind of sensitive soul, is she?
No. Yeah, she's kind of abrupt. She says what she thinks. And you can imagine sitting with that for 30 years is going to do something to your brain,
yeah.
Poor Jón. Luckily, as his little friend Brezhnev to his side to occasionally consult with, which is good. And so, yeah, they meet the Germans and he refuses to back down, which I guess is the first step on him taking life, taking his life back into his own hands.
Wresting control from his mother.
Yeah.
Although she does kind of inspire him to, but...
I guess, but it is still coming from his own brain. Mm. So, yeah, it's like how much of it is his unconscious coming through and how much of it is genuinely just what he imagines his mum would have said.
Yeah.
And so they get through with the Germans, these tourists who are, yeah, doing the classic traveling around Iceland in a camper van. And he spots someone on the beach who looks remarkably like Helga from A Letter from Helga. This is Birgdis, who we come to find out. Well, okay. Is it Birgdis? We don't know. He sees a lady on a beach throwing a beach ball with some friends, and he has this kind of connection with her. He recognizes her. She's played by Hera Hilmarsdottir. Hilmar, of her surname being Hilmar Oddsson, the director of the film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he spots someone he recognizes, and then we find out that she is in the photo in his photo album because he's an amateur photographer. And what are we supposed to think then? Like, oh, someone he knew when he was a kid is still around looking exactly like she did when he was a kid.
I think you're being too literal, Rob. Remember, this is magical realism.
That's right. And I said
I love how you let it go that the dead mum is speaking in the back. But you're like, how does we explain that he sees his old girlfriend?
Well, I think, yeah, okay. So I find it hard with certain things to detach. And the whole Birgdis thing, because we find out, yeah, she was a girlfriend from when he was younger. So she is a real person, but she pops up. This character that we see is obviously not her.
But I think it's just, she's a vision.
She's not, there's no one there at all.
Or there's somebody that looked a bit like her, but like that's kind of triggering his imagination to see her.
Yeah, perhaps. Because that he gets recurring visions of her, doesn't he? And they get more and more kind of weird and absurd. And you're like, well, that's... What is that? So, yeah, okay, projection of his thing. Yeah. But I don't know. At least his mum is actually there.
Mm. But she's not talking, is she? That's his imagination. God, I love how you'll just go with the rules of the game in some things, but not with...
I know, I really should just let it all...
Yeah. Let wash over you. It's a dreamscape.
I normally do. I don't know what I'm doing. Hanging on to Birgdis like this. So we get our first glimpse of her and his thought processes around this person he used to know. And then we move on to chapter two. And this is like, he really is in a world that he doesn't understand
or recognize. Oh, this is one of the weirdest sequences, I think. So he turns up at a kind of restaurant, bar,
I think it's a hotel with... But like the only place around that people can go?
It feels like it's the middle of the day from the sky.
Mm.
But they're like on some absolute mad one.
I think it's like late night on a Saturday or something, right?
Yeah, but why is the sky so light?
Because it's summer.
Fine, maybe. But anyway, there's loads of just like drunk people. Absolutely giving it their all.
Oh my goodness.
Not even karaoke, like what would you call that? Like club singer style.
Is that like kind of cabaret? Yeah, I don't really know.
And the women seem bizarrely drawn to this strange, silent man who, you know, is not in any way glamorous or charming.
Well, in certain films and certain circumstances, the lone outsider who doesn't speak can be quite attractive. I'm thinking Clint Eastwood here. Not that Thrust the Layer is Clint Eastwood in any respect, but yeah, they're all drawn to him, I assume, because there aren't many people. He's still in the Westfjords, basically, at that point. There's not much around.
He's a red-blooded male.
Yeah.
So there's no one else.
And they are red-blooded females.
Very much so.
Full of booze and fun. And it is awkward and cringe and all those things.
This was strange for like his characterization. So he's got his dead mum in the car and his mission is to take her where she needs to go. But he decides to just like go off and get involved with these women.
Well, that's not his plan, is it? His plan is to get some food because he's hungry.
It just felt like, come on, man, is this the time? Your mum died yesterday. Keep your eyes on the prize.
Yeah, but also he's like exploring the world. Mm-hmm. He's never really done this. And these are characters. I absolutely love that scene with, oh, I can't even remember, Dua, I think her name was, who went up and started singing, oh, yes, sir, I can boogie. With the weird guy, the classic, classic DJ, wedding DJ kind of guy with his, does he have, has like a keyboard or a synthesizer and he's singing along. He sings Happy Birthday and they all sing weird songs and it's like, what is going on?
Yeah.
Oh, now I'm my leader.
Oh, now I'm my leader.
Oh, now I'm
It's very, very weird, but somehow that all leads to Yeon having sex with the drunk lady.
Yeah, very strange.
So weird.
But again, maybe like you say, it's this idea of, because he's just been living in a farm with his mum and nobody else, he's missed out on all these experiences in life. And so I guess this would be like, you know, the experience he'd have got if he'd have gone to university or he'd like lived, you know, lived in a city when he was young. But he's getting it all kind of,
he's getting the middle age version.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. They assume he's with people. He's with at least one person. Who's stayed in the car? The missus. So she has no qualms about sleeping with a guy who's who she assumes partner's outside. So that tells you their moral compass. but he, yeah, he doesn't really know what's happening, but he goes along with it, as you might. I don't know. Very strange. And this is the hotel. This is the hotel is Hotel Bjarkadalur or something, which is the exact place that Thomas Le Marquis, who plays a hitchhiker, says he's on his way to. And Yeon just completely kind of like shuts him down by accident and drives off. I love every time we see Thomas and Marquise. It's the kind of language thing makes me laugh so much. Their conversations where neither of them know what the other one is saying, and yet they still have these conversations. It cracks me up. And that's the first one where he could really have actually helped him there, and he did not.
Feel bad for him, this innocent hitchhiker going to stay at what he thinks is a nice, quiet provincial hotel, turning up there to, yes, sir.
Well, hopefully he turned up a lot later than that. And then we move from that, and like, there's all sorts of stuff happening at the sort of same time. Someone mentions that a comet is coming. Well, I don't really know what that's about. And it kind of just gets mentioned and forgotten. Brezhnev is then left with some farmers because Yeon runs over a dog.
And they need to, you know, one in, one out.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair point. Yeah, it must happen often. I think his moral compass is relatively straight. I think my favourite moment of this film is when he goes to the farm and he's gone in for like a cup of tea and some biscuits. And they just joke about his mum being dead. He says that she's dead.
Yeah.
And they're just like, dead tired, am I right? Basically. And I don't know if that's like they were a real farming couple and they just got roped into it, but they absolutely cracked themselves up.
Yeah.
I loved it. That was just, it was remarkable.
Again, just these bizarre little vignettes.
Yeah. You go from a dead dog, really could be potentially really sad. He gets shot as well. Like, this is like tonally really dark and sad, and then you go cut straight to this scene of them laughing at a dead woman sat in a car. Just absolutely absurd, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely.
So then we move on and we get a third chapter, Each Road from Home is the Way Home. I don't know, I'm not going to try and explain that one to you, but it's at this point we start learning more about his backstory and meet some more people that knew him in the past. And so we learn about Mum's relationship with her husband.
Yeah.
And we learn about what Yeon has been doing for these 30 years and essentially, there's so many shades of A Letter from Helga in this. So many. And so we find out basically that Mum was a young girl in her teens, married this strong, wealthy farmer, took her up north, and then wanted for nothing outside the county and the fjord. So she's married this guy and then she's just stuck, basically.
Yeah. I think that was quite a nicely kind of done section, because it could have been easy to just been like, this guy's mum is a real old battle axe. She's horrible. She's destroyed his life. But here we kind of we flesh out her character a bit and realise maybe why she was embittered, why she was keen to leave and go somewhere else, and why she was maybe had that kind of harsh, cynical perspective on life, because she herself had a difficult time. And I think that's quite sympathetic to her.
Yes, I think so. But considering she's been through this, why is she then denying her son the opportunity to get out
maybe
there?
Maybe he's her only joy, you know. He's her only joy. She wants to keep him close.
Yeah, okay.
Or just people get bitter and twisted, don't they? And that's, you know, cycles of pain. If somebody has a horrible time, quite often they inflict that on others.
That's true.
The next generation.
And that's what she's done. And it's, yeah, like you say, it's sad for her, but sad for Jon as well. I mean, we can jump ahead a bit, but he finds out later on that he should have left home, basically. He did that thing that Bjarni did in A Letter from Helga. And if you haven't seen A Letter from Helga, we just talked about it on the last episode of the podcast, so what are you doing? But Bjarni couldn't make up his mind. He couldn't leave home. He couldn't leave the farm that had been in his family for generations. And it's kind of similar here, where Jon even has the line, I couldn't decide what to do, and did he ever make a decision in time? We don't know. It doesn't seem like he did. But it does deviate from Bjarni's story in a way, and that comes later on in this chapter, actually. He basically says of Bergdís, because that's the girl that he was in love with, that he was going to think about moving in with. But she didn't want, and this is a quote, she didn't want to live in the countryside, and I told her I had to think about it. And what's that left him with? 30 years of not leaving the countryside.
Of regret. It's kind of the lost love, lost opportunity. The thing that really, I think, you'd dread most, looking back on your life and thinking, what have I done? I've missed out on all these opportunities, and I've just, rather than living, I've just stayed at home because I'm scared of what my mum thinks and nervous and afraid.
I can't get away from the fact it's like Bjarni, just he decided to spend his life just living rather than, well, not even really living, just
existing
in this space away from everyone else. And at least in this film, certainly at this point, it looks like Jon might be able to break free. He's certainly left for a start, which is something. And it's at this point they're having this talk, and then Bergdís reappears again. So you've said, okay, this is a figment of his imagination. Fine. What the hell is this troop that she keeps walking around with, crossing through the town? So there's a point earlier on where he's in his car in another small town and they cross the road. She's wearing, and this is the one reading I have of any of the bits of her in the film. Mm. She's wearing a white dress carrying a doll or a baby. So that for me was like a projection of what he could have had if he'd actually gone with her.
I wonder if this was slightly a moment of style over substance, and they thought, wouldn't it look amazing if we had all these kind of weird circusy people floating about? Wouldn't that be dreamlike and bizarre? And it does look, it's very aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah.
But I just read it as maybe, you know, she was in like some kind of 60s art troupe, you know, like art theatre troupe, political theatre or whatever. Which is, they loved that kind of thing in like the 60s.
I suppose so.
And so maybe that's how he's like remembering her.
Okay, yeah. It makes sense. I'm on board. And yeah, so this point after we've learned about him, she appears in the middle of nowhere when a car's broken down. And yeah, he's trying to come to terms with everything. And then the hitchhiker turns up. It's like, what? This is this moment when the car breaks down, there's mist. It's all very kind of...
dreamy.
Yes, so dreamy. Bergdis returns. The dog, Brezhnev, appears out of nowhere as well. Clever dog. He's travelled quite far, as you think. And then the hitchhiker appears. And it's this moment of where, for me, it felt like, okay, we're going through this moment of transition, really, where he's going to break out, like the car's stopped. Once the car's going again, he's on his way. And that's pretty much what happens. But again, there's that moment of catharsis with the hitchhiker, isn't there? Where they have this conversation, neither of them really understanding each other. But it's like a moment of connection where they're like, we're both kind of...
And I think that the fact that they don't understand each other kind of frees them up. I mean, Yone is definitely like a man of a certain age who doesn't talk about feelings. So the time that he kind of can do that is when he knows that the guy doesn't understand him. So it's always kind of an inner monologue, but it does allow them to have, as you say, that moment of connection.
Mm-hmm. And that's really, I mean, as a device, that's really all the hitchhiker's doing.
Mm.
But it provides this extra kind of layer of like, oh, his situation is perhaps worse. He's dying and he's come to Iceland for, I don't know, just to see out his time. He says his Reykjavik reminded him of his girlfriend and he's out there just wandering around. He reminded me of the character in Woman at War and the other one that he turns up in, is it Of Horses and Men? Just this foreigner just floating around, just popping up here and there, helping out when they can.
But I guess it all touches on the central theme of, if you look back, what will you have made of your life? And what will you have to reflect on? So he's maybe dying, but he's like, well, I'm going to cram in all the stuff I can while I can. And that, again, is very pertinent to what Yone is experiencing.
All these things are building up in his mind to help him make that final decision to kind of break free. And that's what happens. Like in the next sort of chapter... or it might even be in this chapter, he starts ignoring his mum, which hasn't happened up to this point. He's like, no, I'm not going left, because she's been directing him the whole time. Instead of going to Eyrarbakki, he decides, fuck this, I'm going to where I know Bergdís was last. This is when the film could have got truly emotional. Like it really could have pulled at the heartstrings. It could have made the drama so kind of intense. But instead, Yone pawns up at the house, hoping to meet Bergdís. Mm. Instead, he meets Bergdís.
Her daughter. Bergdís too.
Bergdís too. and her daughter. And Bergdís is not there. She lives in Australia. And he goes in for a chat. Which we don't see.
No!
What?
We're deprived of the drama.
That's mad to me that you can make a film this effective without even including the moment where the big reveal that he had a daughter.
And he didn't know about it. But I guess we get the big reveal. Maybe we're holding back that big reveal rather than with a character we've just been introduced to.
Yeah.
We get it between Yone and his mum, which is the central dynamic.
Yes.
So we're like... just stockpiling that key moment for our two central characters to...
Yeah, because it's more emotionally charged if he's having that dialogue with his mum. And that dialogue is, I got sent a letter from Bergdís telling me
I had a daughter.
You never told me. You never passed this message on. Now I've missed out on X many years of her life.
To be fair, that is so toxic.
Fucking hell.
That is bad.
That's really bad. To withhold a letter, no matter what it says, is bad. To withhold a letter that you know contains this important information.
Yeah.
His life would have been entirely different. That could have been, And it seems like it would have been a driving force for him to leave the Westfjords and move.
Yeah.
And be with Bergdis.
He's had that life stolen from him and that time stolen from him by his mum.
Psychologically, how do you recover? I don't know. You can scream a lot.
Yeah.
You know, men like to scream.
Or you could do what Yone does. Set fire to the car with your dead mum in it.
I absolutely love it. Isn't that just perfect? And this is in the chapter, When Does a Woman Kill a Man?
Yeah.
Which is an interesting title. Are we saying that mum has effectively killed Yone for 30 years?
I'm unclear about the chapter titles.
Because the next chapter is When Does a Man Kill a Woman?
But again, but he's not already, killing her.
He's never killed her. And it's not even in that chapter that he does do the burning. Things to think about.
That's a good way of avoiding it, yeah. Answering them.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, like you said, he burns his mum alive. Not alive. He burns his mum dead. He burns his mum dead. And it looked like it was done for real.
Yeah, hard to tell.
Hard to tell, which is great if it
again,
is
maybe
effect.
The, you know, the black and white is helping with that.
Covering up any sins of the effects. But it looks fantastic. And the cheek of it, of him to drive and almost be at the churchyard.
That is vengeance.
It's so good. And like we said, she didn't want to be cremated.
Yeah. And fire is, you talked about this as a moment of catharsis. Fire is like a classic cleansing catharsis thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. That's it, all sins washed away, essentially. Mm. Like, it's a fresh start. And Iceland knows this well. Like, from lava, from death and destruction can come new life. And
from ashes to ashes.
Yeah. But it's true though, like he basically starts a whole new life after that moment, doesn't he? It doesn't start necessarily the way you might want a new life to start though.
Yeah, with getting sent to prison. Yeah, no, ideally not.
No.
He's not really thought it through, has he? It's definitely an impulse rather than a concerted plan.
True. A very good kind of symbolic impulse. But like, I don't think you would necessarily expect all the people you met on your journey to, all these eyewitnesses confirming that his mum was alive the whole time.
I think that's a little comedy sting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because he's never really actually said, oh, she is alive. He kind of tells everyone, yeah, she's dead.
He literally says she's dead so many times.
Yeah. But the fact that all of these people think they're like really smart or observant or whatever, and none of them have actually realised that she's dead.
No.
It's a good little black comedy sting.
It's really good. And that includes a policeman. We haven't even talked about him, but the policeman who knows them, he tries to talk to his mum and doesn't get a response, but just assumes that she doesn't want to speak to him.
Yeah.
And so you can't really ask for a better eyewitness than a police officer. So when someone like that says, yeah, she was alive, what? How do you deny burning your mum in the car alive? It's very good.
Yeah.
It's so unexpected. It's brilliant. His new life starts because he gets sent down for killing his mum, I guess.
Yeah, but he kind of, weirdly, even that is a fresh start. Shakes things up a bit, I guess.
He starts having a purpose.
Yeah, so he's teaching everyone in the prison how to knit.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely stuff.
I love that jumper that the one of them knits with the middle finger.
Yeah.
So good. I mean, it probably took quite a lot of work to do that. So
it's
impressed.
A complex pattern.
He's obviously teaching them well.
Mm.
He teaches them that. And what else is he doing? Oh, he's taking photos, of course. And it's quite funny because the prison guards, I mean, it seems to be quite a chill prison. He's in Litlehroin, which is the prison we've seen a few times, which is basically the only
prison in Iceland. But it does seem quite relaxed, certainly the wing he's in. And they seem to like love him and want him, almost like trying to entice him to stay.
I wondered if that final sequence, the kind of prison sequence, went on a little bit too long, that maybe it would have been better just as a very short coda.
Yeah, I don't think we need to see so much of the prison guards talking about Rocky.
Yeah.
Why was Rocky in there?
Again, just a moment in time, I guess.
Yeah, it was out. But yeah, I think it was maybe a couple of minutes too long. Mm. But I just love that a fresh start starts with prison.
Yeah. But we didn't revisit any sense of him connecting with his daughter at the end. In fact, we get a sense of him kind of moving on from the past, because he takes the photo of him and Birgdis and lets it waft out the window on the breeze.
That's
which
true.
Which is obviously symbolic of him letting go of the past.
Okay.
But I thought, now you've got a daughter, so you should probably follow that up.
I guess there's two possible options, isn't there? You reconnect, well, you connect for the first time with your daughter, or you go, I don't know who you are. I have never known you. Why should I? I mean, that's a really depressing thought. Yeah. And not one that I would want to follow, but I guess it's a possibility. Talking of Birgdis in photos, yes, he throws the one out the window. All the ones he took of her.
Yes, I knew you were going to bring this up. Do you think that the laws of this world are a bit muddled? You know, this magical realist world. So the photos that he's taken of her, when, by our theory earlier, she is just a figment of his imagination. Mm. He develops those photos and she is on them.
Yeah. No, do I actually think that she's on them? Mm. Yes. I can't explain it. And I wouldn't use the word muddled. I think the director knows exactly what he's doing. It's just another example of him playing with that idea and just toying with us. Like, I don't know. You can't explain it. And that's the point of magical realism. You just accept it and move on. And yeah, I don't know why I'm clinging to Birgdis so much, to be honest with you, because I love magical realism. I read Haruki Murakami all the time. And I just accept things. You take it as read. It just is. So yeah, she's there. She's gone, but she's still there. And it obviously ends with her. More circusy, dancey art stuff.
I think that's just an aesthetic choice for the end.
Because that film, the film could have ended just with the photograph floating.
It was all a dream at the end.
Whoa. Do you think the whole thing was not real?
No, but it's got a dream. It's just a reiteration of, ooh, wasn't it all weird? Wasn't all of that weird? Think of that.
I want to give Hilmar Oddsson a bit more credit than that, to be honest. But I am struggling to know exactly what that means. Yeah, maybe you're right. But I'd like to, the film feels so accomplished that I feel like there is a meaning there. Mm. I'm just not getting it. And maybe it's one of those contextual things that we...
You're just too dumb to know.
It's me. It's me. I watched it twice and I just can't get it. So yeah, Driving Mum, a very accomplished film from a director we've not really seen much of. He hasn't made a lot. He did make a film with Ingvar Sigurdsson in, Cold Light, which we might come to one day. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to just touch on, we've talked about the way it looks, but what about the way it sounds? Like I said, tonally, it is kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
And I think the same can be said for the music. Like,
how so?
How so? Well, at times it's really melancholic. At times it's like really upbeat. There's moments where I thought it sounded like Leonard Cohen, I'm Your Man. Like it kind of goes, dum do do dum 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 do do dum do 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 do. Like, oh yeah, am I supposed to be like, you know, really joyful right now? But sometimes it doesn't always match.
But I think
what we're seeing.
So because the performances are quite straight and quite dry, I think sometimes we need a little, that's like a little kooky tune, isn't it? Like dun 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 dun. Like It reminds me of the band in Woman at War.
Of course, that, yeah.
It's kind of setting the tone of like, ooh, this is a bit eccentric and, you know, it's not a serious drama.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bit offbeat.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely doing that. And then at other times, like, really kind of dreamy and nostalgic. And I guess that does fit. So some of the music is fitting with, like, the tone, and some of the music is fitting with, like, Jon's inner thoughts. Like, he's reminiscing about Bergdís, and we get this kind of melancholic sound and nostalgic sound. We even get choral music again,
classic.
which is a classic, and, you know, I'm sure everyone's heard it growing up. I'm sure even Jon heard it growing up. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a funny thing, the music, but I think it works quite well, and I think it is necessary to have some of that more upbeat stuff, considering the actual content of this film is about driving a dead lady across country.
My final concluding thought, she's remarkably good at staying upright, the dead lady.
Yeah, she sits quite still. I mean, how quick does rigor mortis take? By the time he got her to the car, that might be the point where she's actually just stuck. She starts getting solid. But a great performance, such a strange performance. Kristbjörg Kjelt plays Mama. How do you act that?
Just close your eyes and stay eyes. Still.
But it works. Could anyone have done that? I'm not sure, but she does such a great job of just when she does open her eyes, she's like really stern, and you can sense the relationship that's there, and that's obviously helped by seeing her alive for 5 minutes. But this is really Thruster Leo's film, isn't it? Like, we've seen him a lot, but we've never seen him front of film before.
Yeah.
And I think he does such a great job of holding it together, portraying this guy who lived and didn't enjoy his life or resented or whatever. And I was, I watched an interview with the director, actually, this one online, from the Tallinn Film Festival. And he talked about how this film came to be. Basically, he talked to Thruster Leo in the 90s. And Thruster Leo is from the area that they actually filmed the film. I think I mentioned that a very long time ago on this podcast, that he was basically just a fisherman who occasionally acted. But he's getting a lot more work these days. But they had this chat about this idea that they wanted to do something up in the West Fjords, where he's from, in the 90s. It was always going to be black and white. Thruster Leo was always telling these stories about the people, which is, I guess, where some of these vignettes come from.
Oh, yeah.
He's met the these women.
Eccentric people.
Yeah. And, yeah, basically, it's all come from... It's taken, 30 years to get this to the screen. And I guess Thruster Leo is kind of the right age for it by this point. But that journey is just mad, isn't it? And he also said something that I found really interesting. And this can be, like, the final point, I guess. But he uses the landscape to reflect the journey that Jon is going on in his mind. He goes from these mountainous, remote areas to really, really flat land.
Yeah.
And sort of the expanse and his world is now much open. Yeah. And that's a nice thought to end on, isn't it?
Very nice.
You always heard the one. The one you shouldn't hurt at all. You always take the sweetest rose and crush it till the petals fall.
Thanks again to Ellie for yet another fun and insightful discussion. And Driving Mum is out in the UK from today. So keep your eyes peeled on your local indie cinemas, including Home in Manchester and Showroom in Sheffield, as it'll continue to roll out across the country throughout the month of March. It'll look brilliant on the big screen, so check it out when you can, and help us continue to spread the word that Icelandic films are fantastic and worth distributing in the UK. If you liked it, let us know, and we'll be back soon to discuss the 2016 crime film Cruelty, or Grimmed, which is currently available to buy for 99p from Apple TV. See you then. Tack og bless. Thanks and goodbye.